Hello there, my name's Dave Starbuck, and welcome to another presentation from Revelation Tapes. By and large, most whistleblowers prefer to keep a very low profile, especially if there's been attempts on their lives, like some of the people I've interviewed. This, of course, is quite understandable. However, certain whistleblowers don't mind stepping center stage, so to speak, and one such man, a former intelligence insider, born in New Zealand, now residing in Scotland, has no qualms about going public. His name is Dean Wallach, and he has a very interesting story to tell. So, without further ado, we'll go over to Dean Wallach in Scotland.
Right, good evening, Dean, and first of all, welcome to Revelation Tapes and agreeing to this interview. Now, before we get down to the nitty-gritty, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you became involved with what you did and so on.
Well, I think that begins right back soon after when I was born. My grandfather was a very close friend and had a lot to do with my upbringing along with my parents. My grandfather was the Secretary of the New Zealand Justice Department and Prisons Paroles Board. He was a 1920 degree Mason. He was not keen on certain aspects of Masonry, although he admitted it had to be a part of his life. He studied Chinese detection and became world renowned for it. Could pick people from a crowd and put tails on them, which was done regularly, well known to me as a child, being first hand evidencing these events. He told me something as he was dying. He had cancer, and I spent a lot of time with him. I was about 15, and he said that later on in life, I would learn something which he couldn't divulge to me, something that would practically destroy me. And I am quite convinced I do know what it is that he was talking about, and it is truly horrifying. It is not being made public. I have yet to see, read, or hear anywhere of evidence of that which I have learned of and have many confirming reports from police around the UK and from church groups that I was mixed with in the United States before coming to the UK. I was drafted into the New Zealand Army. I topped every course during my officer's training preparation for Vietnam. I was taught how to bring down the Twin Towers using nothing but infrasound.
Really?
We were made to study the experiments by the Russians, the Americans, and the British in the late 50s.
In the late 50s?
Late 50s. This was mid-60s when I was in the military. But here were these joint maneuvers being undertaken in the late 50s by these three superpowers then in the Eastern Bloc, bringing down 25-story buildings using nothing but sound wave infrasound.
Good heavens.
And I did discuss this of recent years with a Professor Francie, who remarked, this, that, and the other thing with respect to that 9/11 farce that we saw. And of course, we all know that Michael Meacher, who was a cabinet minister, was removed from office because he publicized the fact that he had read word for word what was to happen to the Twin Towers 3 years before the event.
3 years before the event?
3 years before the event. It was a well-planned thing. It was a well-known thing as a civil and structural engineer, and I have teaching instruments, postgraduate universities, polytechs around the world in my research into certain aspects and of engineering, that is. And I knew that there was a calling many years before that the Twin Towers would have to be, should be demolished, which was an engineering facet to the overall game here. And what people do not understand when it comes to New York is the New York Port Authority demand that any building erected in New York must be able to be brought down within its own footprint. In other words, we don't want a 50-story Church. Now, there is something with the Twin Towers which many people have not picked up on. Apart from the films that we have seen, and we see, for example, what we didn't see for 6 months, we saw nothing of the second Twin Towers building being hit on its face. And I was suspicious about this, thinking there's something they don't want us to know. Then we were told there was to be this screening of this bit of footage showing the plane actually striking the face, and I made a point of seeing it. I sat in front of the television, I saw the plane strike, and I put my head in my hands and I said, "Oh, you bastard, you bloody did it, all right." Talk about some Muslims taking over planes, etc. Forget it. I couldn't establish and prove that with the first Twin Towers building, but certainly with the second. And what I saw was, as the plane struck, or the hologram presentation of a plane when it was really a pod that struck, was that the actual structure, the material making up the external skin, each section weighing around 40 tons, it behaved exactly the way it should have done had it been influenced by infrasound, which is what I witnessed with the training that I was doing in the mid-60s, watching what the Brits, the Russians, and the Americans had been doing in Eastern Europe back in the late 50s. So I don't believe much of what is 9/11. The other thing with 9/11, which very few people, well, in fact, I haven't seen anything spoken of publicly about this, but there is a building, and about 15, 20 stories up off the ground, if you get a look at it, you will see that the corner of this building, which is way distant from the Twin Towers positioning, three of its floors are torn apart on the corner. Now, there was no way that material from the Twin Towers could have flown out and struck that building.
Not at all.
So, in my discussions, arguments with Professor Francy, I said that as far as I was concerned, that infrasound influence upon those buildings was satellite-based. And, of course, his remark to me was, "Well, how could that be, Dean?" He said, "We couldn't have anything from space coming in by way of sound wave, infrasound." And I said, "Yeah, but it could be electromagnetic, and then it's transposing itself as it gets within our atmosphere." The thing here to understand is that people don't appreciate the only thing that travels through space. Light, there's no such thing as light from the sun. It's electromagnetic radiation. And in the event of light, for example, it's when that electromagnetic radiation enters the atmosphere of the Earth, it agitates the gas, and that is daylight. There's no such thing as light from the sun, and that's how, for example, we don't have to look at photographs and analyze them of Aldrin and Armstrong walking on the moon. We know they didn't take photographs on the moon because there's no such thing as light on the moon. We see the moon because we see a reflection of the electromagnetic field striking boulders, craters, and mountains, and comes back down into our atmosphere, where it is then lit up and becomes like going to the cinema. Anyway, with respect to the Twin Towers event, something other than conventional thinking would have to have applied, but this building is the telltale that that was not struck by debris from one of the Twin Towers, and so what influenced it to be broken apart? And the thinking for me was that it had to have been some form of infrasound that was played on the a large area in which the Twin Towers occupied. And Professor Francy was quite taken with that idea, went along with it, although one hasn't ever had the opportunity of proving such. As I said, served my time New Zealand Army. I was a crack shot with any hand weapon. I equaled top shot out of 8,500, and as such, I'm in a position to say that, irrespective of the argument that's put forward, there is no way that Oswald could have cocked his rifle, shouldered it, eyed sighted his target, and put pulled the trigger in as many times as he's supposed to have fired shots at John Kennedy. I couldn't have done it. Well, he certainly couldn't have done it because I was a far better shot than Oswald. He may have been able to pull back the bolt and pull the trigger that many times, but he certainly didn't get to sight his target and pull the trigger. And one thing's for certain, on the amount of shooting that I've done over the years, the only way that the forehead of Jack Kennedy was lifted and hinged on his left-hand side and his body thrown across that back of that car was he was that shot, that particular bullet, came from the grassy knoll. Did not come from any book depository.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was pretty moved by the Jack Kennedy assassination. I was actually in the shower at home at the time it happened. I was quite dismayed. I was one of the world's super athletes. I was vice captain of the first New Zealand team to be called Junior All Blacks. I took the world record freestyle start time off Jan Conrads of Australia in 1959. I was 15 years of age. I represented New Zealand in the World Surfing Championships in Hawaii in 67. I went on and I was signed by the San Francisco Commissioner to play with the 49ers 67, 68, and then became a breakstyle swimming coach with the American Olympic team that went to the Mexico Olympics. I was made a member of the Jack Nicklaus Invitation Only Sportsman's Club International in 1968. But I got a job with a foreign government in the States in 1968, and I was interviewed by that particular government. And then my interviews went to the State Department and the FBI, and I was told that if I wanted the job, I'd have to wear a gun. I said, "You want me to do this job? I'm wearing no gun." "What's your problem, buddy?" And I said, "The trouble is that you guys are gun mad over here."
And he's been absolutely right, yeah.
And as I said, "I've got no family. I know nobody in this place. And there'll be somebody get teed off with me, and then there'll be a convenient accident. I've got no influence at all, so I'm wearing no gun. I'll carry a knife." And I did. I carried a knife strapped to the ankle of my left leg everywhere I went. Well, there were three major events for me in that job, apart from the fact that I worked for half a dozen foreign governments and was on call to the State Department to do their bidding, or a government department. Often I didn't know who I was working for. I just took instructions and did what I was told. But I did subsequently, in fact, break the world record for the number of 8-inch hollow concrete blocks to be laid in a day. And it was because of my eye for detail that I actually managed to break open the biggest fraud in the history of the American Air Force.
Really?
And following on that, if my boss told me to do something, I did it at the opposite of what he would set me up to do. And I went to this place, and I'm sitting in a car, and these women kept coming to the window. And of course, the only person that drives a black car in Southern California has got to be government.
Yeah,
and
the money black.
I'm looking through this window, and I've got a very, very keen eye. And I could see right down through the back of this condominium office block, and I thought, "That's funny. Those concrete blocks, you Yanks are better at laying blocks than that. There's something not right." And suddenly I clicked. I thought, "Hold on a minute. Is that actual block laying? Well, somebody put those blocks back in position." So I went into the office, past the receptionist, and asked to see the managers. And from there on led the scenario whereby I got the information that was required and the scam was exposed. So I got confidence from certain successes, and my boss, whose name I might say did begin with M, he was an English university don, spoke 27 languages fluently, had been a Royal Naval Commander during the Second World War, raiding into Europe, and he would give me work that other people just didn't understand. I was given responsibility, and for me, the actual assassination of Bobby Kennedy begins 2 weeks before the day, which I'm not sure the date, but it was July 68. I think it was the 23rd of July Bobby was assassinated. But 2 weeks before that, I had with me a man and his wife. He was the leader designate of one of the United States' closest allies, large country, I don't want to say who, and they'd been with me. I'd been responsible for them for about a week. Very, very close I got to the lady, and because I had ticked her off on the first day that I had them, and she would sit in the front seat of the car with me, and he would do his work in the back, and we'd take him where he needed to go, and then she and I would have lunch, whatever. And this final day we were together, we had gone through Disneyland, and I was supposed to leave them, and other security was to pick them up from downtown LA, maintain them, and then see them off on their private flight the following morning. Anyway, I took them to the helicopter pad at Disneyland. He got out the car, and she got out the car, I got out the car. And I'm standing there next to this helicopter, and I'm looking at it, and she turns around, and she says, "Dean, what's the matter?" I said, I don't know, something's wrong. She said, "Darling, we're not going back on this, come on, we're going back with Dean." He just flew into the car. Yeah. She got in the car, I got in the car and drove off. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the thing that saved our lives that day, apart from the fact that they didn't get on that helicopter, but the thing that saved us all was that the firm's car, the black car, was in the workshop in the garage. And one of Hollywood's most beautiful women had loaned us her car, which was a two-tone cream and green, a green Chevy. So we weren't any obvious government connection.
Yeah.
I drove up Orange Boulevard away from Disneyland, dropped onto the on-ramp, down onto the freeway, started to accelerate, and the two of them sitting in the back this time, and she says, "Darling, oh, there's our helicopter." The helicopter lifted up, got to the top of its climb, pitched to go forward. There was a small puff of smoke underneath the helicopter in line with the axis of the rotors, and then woof! Black smoke poured out around the rotors. Helicopter turned on its nose, dived for the deck. All people, about 20 odd people on board, were killed. I hit the accelerator, yelled out, "Down your targets," and took off. Yelling at me, "Dean, get me to a phone, quickly, get us to a phone." So I get up off the freeway, he's on the phone, I can hear him yelling out, you know, "We're okay, we're all right, we're alive, we're all right, we'll call you later." Get back in the car. I made downtown Los Angeles 32 miles faster off the freeway than I had ever done it on the freeway. Never pulled a cop. Got to the hotel where they'd been staying, and I said, "You're out, we're just getting you out of there now." Went into the hotel with him. She was in the back. I called a cop who was walking on the road and said who I was, what had happened. "Look after the car." Mind her, she's down low in the car, keeping her out of sight. Went into the hotel, got all their gear out, and put them in a rinky-dink downtown LA. My idea was always, got a problem, go right to the heart of it. Don't run away from it, you'll be too obvious. Get right in amongst it. And we went out to a Greasy Spoon for something to eat, and I said, "Everything is cancelled, just don't you speak to anybody, no calls, I'll pick you up 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'll get you to the flight," which I did, and nobody tailed us at all. This time, I've now changed the car, and I'm driving a Dodge Charger, which I had, like the Dukes of Hazzard thing, 380 horsepower, and 0 to 60 in 5.7 seconds, 162 mile an hour sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left them at the plane, and she's saying, "Dean, I wish you could come with us," obviously thinking, you know, but for the fact I was with them, they'd have been in a pile of smoldering wreckage of a helicopter at Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And I took off back, and as I drove off, I'm thinking, there's got to be something, it's gone too easy, there's got to be something happen. I got up to the crossroads where the close road ducks down underneath the runway of LA Airport, and I could see, because the road goes down and then up again, I could see two tyres, wheels of a car, and I thought somebody's hiding in there. And I sat on the crisscross of the crossroads, and this car started to come forward. I thought, here we go. So I eased forward, no more than a snail's pace sort of thing. And this car comes out of the underpass, sits on the crisscross. I stop the car, and I'm taunting them, thinking, you come for me, boy. That's it, I'm off. And nobody would have caught me. I was too good behind the wheel of the car. Anyway, they didn't. They went straight on the way they were facing. And I thought, yeah, but they can come up and meet me somewhere. So I went up a couple of blocks across to the right and went to the security office of TRW Systems, who I knew, they knew of me, and told them of what had happened. And I said, I need some sleep. I've got to sleep. And they opened the gates and said, come on, park in the back of here. You'll be all right. So that's 5 o'clock in the morning. I slept in the car till 7. And then I left. And I thought, no, I'm still not going downtown, going back into town. This is, anything could happen. I'm going to the beach. So I went down to Muscle Beach, which plenty of people have heard of. I parked the car up at the end of a fairly exposed piece, and I looked around down by the water's edge until 10 o'clock. And then I left, went back to the office, and my boss was first class. Yeah, no problems at all. So I actually then... From that event comes the assassination of Kennedy, but there were all sorts of things going wrong in the States. And for me, that eventing was a part of who was in back of it, what was in back of it, and what we're going to do to make these people understand they're going to dance to our tune. Here's what happened with Bobby Kennedy. So my instructions were that night that I was to be in the coconut grove, mingle with the crowd, and always it was, anything happens at all, create confusion, and out of that, just do something. So I've got a friend of mine, Ralph, who's in the front car, seat of the car, who had been a speaker of Bobby's junior campaign. We get to the Bank of America building on Wilshire Boulevard, which is about two stops from the entrance to the hotel, and I hear 4 shots over the radio. Oh my God, I'm late, something's happened. I stop the car, and then immediately I duck in the driveway. And that saved me again, because I would learn later that just after we had entered the entrance to the driveway, the tall, lanky guy and the girl in the polka dot skirt had come running down the path shouting, we've done it, we've done it, we've killed Bobby Kennedy. And of course, had I seen that, witnessed that, I'd have probably followed them, and I would have been a number just like they turned out to be. They turned up a couple of weeks later with their throats cut. Anyway, I get into the entrance to the hotel, and I get into the ballroom, and I'm wandering, and I'm hearing in my head the voices, those three men. So I go to the phone, I ring my boss, and he says, right, you've got the British consul general and his family, they're at such and such, pick them up, secure, and we'll be in touch. I do that, and I've got them back at their house in Hancock Park, and I'm thinking, well, what can I do? I've got no gun. Okay, I'll act like a loony. I get out the car, and I walk up and down the middle of the road for an hour and a bit, and anybody that may have come into that street would have seen this fool walking up and down the middle of the road, and go somewhere else. That's it, okay? The butler comes to the door, and he waves me in. It's my boss. He says, right, we're going to swap over. You go home. You've got the Attorney General's office. You do whatever he wants. You stick with him. So I leave there about 12:15. I get back, and I'm securing the home of, I'm not going to tell you who it was, but a very famous government official who was married to a woman, the daughter of one of the biggest industrial magnates in the United States. And the phone rings about 10 to 1, and a voice at the other end says, it's the Attorney General's office. Now, we've got a problem here. We can't use any regulars for this. We've got to use a freelance. We've heard of you, Dean. We know what you're capable of. Are you prepared to do this for us? I said, of course. He says, right. He's right, left, at 11 o'clock. He's the principal investigating attorney. Pick him up, secure him, stay with him, whatever he wants, just you maintain him. And don't use any main roads. Any cops, lose them. You know how to do it. So, of course, again, I don't do what I'm told. I don't want anybody thinking, you know, I'm going along a particular line. I'll make my own way. So I get this man from, again, in fact, the same side of the airport where I'd taken the other high-ranking official that had been, you know, nearly been picked up in that event at Disneyland. And we drive in silence. We're about 10 minutes from where I'm going to secure him. And he breaks the silence and he says, "We've got a problem." He said, "We've been under threat for 3 months. It was Eli Lilly, the drugs baron." He said that if Bobby didn't shut up and pull back from reopening his brother's assassination, he'd do him the same as he'd done Jack. So it was Eli Lilly who did the president. And I came out with the remark. I said, "He got." I said, "How the hell are you going to make that public?" I said, "It'd be the Third World War out there. They're crazy. They're mad. They were mad before this happened, as to the event with Jack, and they were demanding Bobby do this, Bobby." They find out that it was one of the country's leading businessmen. He says, "That's the trouble, Dean. There's going to have to be a scapegoat." I drive for a few seconds, and then I said, "Well, I guess he thinks he did it. You're just going to have to let him believe it." Sirhan Sirhan, the only bullet from Sirhan's gun to hit Bobby Kennedy, hit him in the front of the left shoulder. They got three other bullets from three other guns, and that's significant if anybody knows how it works. One in the back of Bobby's head, one in the back of his neck, and one in the back of the shoulder blades, and that was confirmed to me a matter of months later by another attorney who'd been given a role within the defense side of things in the United California Bank on the corner of Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica, who told me again that they had this number of bullets from the back of Bobby. So anyway, this principal investigating attorney, he says to me, "You want to know what it's about, Dean? Read the closing presidential address of Eisenhower." And I suggest everybody does, because that's where we're at. And it goes on and on and on. And now I want to come to something which is, I think I said to you when we first spoke, which has turned me for some time. And that's to do with the killing of the children. We have got, I read a release from the Department of Statistics, United States government, in which it said that every year, take pedophile behavior, put it over there, multiply it up, it's still over there. Every year there will be 150,000 children will disappear in the United States, never be heard of again.
Yeah.
And
yeah, sorry,
3 months later...
Sorry, carry on, Nadine.
Yeah. And 3 months later, I got a similar report. It said that in Central and Southern America, there'll be 350,000. Boing. I did mathematics. I specialized in pure and advanced math university. That's not a coincidence. We've got 0.05% of the population in North America. We've got 0.05% of the population in Central and Southern America. That can't be a coincidence.
No, not at all.
So one day, I've got a suit walks into my showroom, and we get talking, and he says that he's got a meeting at the DSS offices, which is the headquarters for where I live, in this area. And I say, "Oh, you'd be interested in this." So I tell him this, that I'd got these reports and what the figures showed. I said, "I can't understand it." I said, "What do you think it could be? In America, we've got this problem." I said, "We don't have anything like that in the UK." He says, "Oh, yes, we do." He says, "I'll tell you who I am." He said, "I've been with this department for 30 years. He said, "I'm now the head of it." He said, "It's 20 to 25,000 children a year in the United Kingdom." Sometime later, I'm watching television. It's the middle of the day, and I see it as a news item. And a lady comes on who's a part of a group in London. I think their name was the Mothers of the Disappeared. I may have that wrong. But anyway, she says that each year in the UK,
120,000 children between the age of 10 and 23, interesting age group, will leave home, and of which 20% will only, well, sorry, the other way around, 80% will ever be heard or found again. In other words, 20% are missing. Well, 20% of 120,000 makes 25,000 and confirms the figure this man had told me. So what's happening to these kids? I'm talking to a police, chief of police, and he says, you're right about these kids, Dean. He said, one year we recorded in our county 40-something had gone missing. He said, the government came back at us and said, no, no, you got it wrong. It's 60-something this year in your county. I have it from a police officer involved, direct, Dorset Police. Every week, they find 7 to 8 children in the New Forest. They have been slit around their necks, down their shoulders. The skin has been peeled off their backs, and their flesh has been eaten into whilst they are alive. Now, I think this has to do with what my grandfather warned me I would learn about later on. And it brings me to the Jessica and Holly event.
Yes.
Anybody who believes that Ian Huntley had anything to do with the killing of those kids wants their head examined.
And since you mentioned, forgive me interrupting you, Dean, at this point. 4 years ago, I did a presentation, Who Really Murdered Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, the response I had was so tremendous, including from two solicitors and a barrister, no less. Continue with your narrative.
So, what we have is Ian Huntley was there because found in the cuffs of his trousers were seeds from plants that were in this forest, whatever it is. Well, could have gotten from anywhere.
Yes.
They could have been planted. This man is so dumb that he takes these bodies to this place, he strips them of their clothes and pours petrol on them to burn them. Well, anybody who's got half a brain knows that you would leave the clothes on to soak up the petrol to make sure the fire was burning more and more. It would dig in. He takes the clothes back to the school. He gets out a bin from underneath the stage. He puts the clothes in the bin. He sprinkles petrol on them. He sets them alight, waits till they burn so far, and then puts the fire out with the hose. This is a nonsense. We have the case of the lady who has tried to get a newspaper or any form of media to print her story, to present her story. Whether it's true or not, obviously I don't know, but the line is that she worked her dog in that forest every day, and for 2 weeks before Jessica and Holly were discovered, she said military police were blocking those roads.
Correct, yes, I heard that from another source as well.
Right. And then we have the case of the runner who was interviewed outside the court whilst the case was proceeding against Huntley, and he said that he had, for 3 nights, heard he'd been running and run past those woods, and he had heard girls screaming in those woods. So where do we get it, this pat line? Now, my information on what happened to Jessica and Holly is as follows, and it comes from high-ranking American military intelligence, who, as far as I'm concerned, I'll believe their line. They are within government. They are deep within government. Who they are, what they are, is another story. But they regularly, they go out and they slaughter. And those girls' bodies were treated with a means of like a set of talons. And they were raped. Now, whether this was a part of a cult or it's a part of a transmutation of a presence is open to argument. I personally think that David Icke has got a point, but he actually misses the point slightly. And that some of what we've got with to do with reptilians, other entities, is somewhere there, but we're not getting to it. But when we bring this back to the event of the 7 to 8 every week being found in the New Forest in Dorset. And this police officer tells me that one of his associates is one who has to inspect the bodies each time. He is nearly suicidal with what he is finding.
It brings
me back, yeah, it brings me back to a piece which occurs many, many times in the Bible, and they ate the flesh of the children in those days. And there's a reason for that. I am fortunate in that I have a series of products which I do, and I get into the homes of a lot of people. For example, and I will mention something of the Lockerbie disaster.
Yes.
But people, one client, for example, is, well, in fact, two clients are fairly high up in British government scientific research, and they have confirmed that we are what we are because we were cannibals, we did live a particular way. Now, it is that in the biblical record, and much of what Zechariah Sitchin has written of, he tells the story of how those who from heaven to earth came, the Nephilim or the Anakin, which is the reference in some parts of the Bible, they ate the menstrual fluid of their women because from that they could derive an ability to read the mind of the person confronting them. They could communicate without speech. And I will go along with that, and I want to explain later a little bit of what I did at university in New Zealand. But when there comes the time for these people to leave, and there are those who have slavered after man's woman, they've come down to earth, and they've entered unto man's women, and they women have begat giants, and they've died in the process of giving birth, these people were left with a problem. And that was, where did they get the ingredient to give them the abilities their women had gone? They had no ability to derive from man's women the ingredients by consuming the menstrual fluid of man's woman. But they discovered that a terrorized human, a child, whose flesh was eaten, and this I have from this prominent scientific base, and I won't say where, in the United Kingdom, that yes, that is the answer to it, Dean. That if that flesh is consumed, it contains, it is flush with the serotonin, adrenaline, and it gives the similar ingredients to allow them the ability they had of reading the mind of communication without speech. And there are so many references to it in the Bible. But the references should be taken absolutely as written. It doesn't say they ate from the bones of children. It doesn't say that they ate the skin of the children. It says, and they ate the flesh. And that means they had been skinned. It's like the reference in the Bible, which is that supposedly Cain slew his brother Abel. That's not true. It doesn't say that. It says Cain ate Abel. And as a result, he was banished. Now, I can't think of anything worse than a child being terrorized to the extent that they would be and then consumed, as I have had confirmed by police forces who actually do the investigating. This may have something to do with what my grandfather had told me when I was a child, of that which I would learn later on in life. And certainly, I can't think of anything worse than the experience a child would feel, would think of when being subjected to this. But similar to this, I publicized recently in documents that I have put out through Nexus that we have the eventing of the guillotines appearing, which is quoted Revelations 24. Thousands of them being brought into American military bases. What for? A senator stating it's a wonderful way
way to execute the death penalty, excuse the pun. But they don't kill 100 people a year in America. So what do they need thousands of guillotines for? The congresswoman for San Diego, who's publicly stated she's been to Japan and watched where in the factory in Japan where they have been making these things.
Yeah, I've heard a report of this from elsewhere.
Well, it actually was reported on BBC Radio middle of January of 2004 that per container load being shipped into a warehouse in Dune Ray at the rate of 300 per container load. And when the commentator on the BBC starts to lose his rag over it, he's got half a dozen people on the phone saying, "Look, we're mad at him. We're up here handling these bloody things. What the hell is this all about?" Now, I do have a theory. I can quite see that with the callings by some of the world's so-called tops, like Kissinger has said publicly, we need to reduce the population of the planet by 6.5 billion from 7 billion. How are you going to get rid of that number of people? Yes, okay, we can play games with the weather. We can do all sorts of things to allow that we will have massive flooding and there will be people will lose their lives because of global warming and the raising of sea levels, etc.
Yes,
but,
Bob, yeah.
I have it that a farmer in Yorkshire was threatened by the police. Now, I have to just stop there and go back a bit because it was Gunderson who was the biggest metals fabricator in the world in the States, and he was interviewed on television about the fact that he had this contract with the American government to supply thousands of railway box cars, and that in each of these cars was shackles for 150 people. And there is the case of this British doctor and his family that are walking in the forest in Canada close to the American border, come upon the railway marshalling yards not being used, been there for at least 10 years, and there are 50 railway boxcars. They open the doors and on each side, and inside of each one, there are the shackles with a guillotine at the head. Now, I put it to you, just consider that you and I are shackled.
Yeah.
And I am put to the guillotine and you're left waiting till the following day. You're going to be terrified.
You're dead right.
So we get the similar condition as you are terrified. The adrenaline, the serotonin is running. And we have in the ingredients within what you are, apart from the body parts, which is what this senator spoke of, that it was a good way of execution and great for getting body parts. But how do you get 6.5 billion people all over the world to be exterminated? It's like it's such a big thing that the majority of people would say, well, it's just a nonsense. But that's the point. You put something straight in front of somebody, and it's the easiest way to conceal it. It's like the Germans rearming for the Second World War. They could build, they could make guns and armament parts and bullets, and they could dig holes in the ground and bury them. But the one thing they couldn't hide was a gun barrel. So what did they do? They got people, they had them erected, sticking through the sheds of people, through the roofs of people's sheds out the back of their houses, and told them to light a bit of paper underneath them every day. And, oh, look, Helmut's got a new stove. So the gun barrel was right there in plain view. Nobody realized the gun barrel. They thought it was a smokestack.
Well, this has been a policy of the New World Order Brigade for a long time. If you want to hide anything, hide it in plain view.
Yeah.
And I can speak with, well, some authority on that. Before I got into journalism, I used to earn my living as a professional comedy magician, so I'm quite used to hiding things in plain view. Sorry, I interrupted you.
It's like to come back to another event. We take the issue of Lockerbie. People believe, or there was a case that ran whereby some Libyans were supposed to have put some detonating explosive onto this airplane. Here's what actually happened that night and the following day, what was told to me. And again, from what I do and getting into people's houses, one of my systems is in a property of a man who has to know everything
thing that happened to every single body that came off that plane, be it the piece up on the hill or what was down in the town. And he told me that seven people survived the crash. Seven people survived the crash, and this has come from another source as well. And that the last person to die was a woman at 6:45 in the morning, died of hypothermia. She had only a broken wrist. The Dumfries and Galloway police, and I have it from within Dumfries and Galloway police, disgusting it is, they were under instructions, nobody is to leave that plane, they die on the hill. Within 12 minutes of that plane striking the ground, and there are photographs, and I think they've actually been put out on television, there are photographs of officials in that town with FBI on the backs of their jackets. The British police turn up from Glasgow. What the hell's this? And it's practically wide earth country. Those two sets of authorities are facing each other with guns drawn. A little bit after this, I have somebody comes to stay who was a lead producer with Granada TV, and he tells me what they had from that event. The day after the crash, certain mountain rescue teams, Scottish, were put out on the hill to track down things, and this one particular group that has some of Scotland's leading trackers, they telephone Granada that following night and they say they've discovered something, they're terrified, they're going back on the hill the following day. If they're still alive and kicking, they've made it through the night from what had happened. They've gone out on the hill and they've come across an area where there was a military looking type tarpaulin. And there were 3, 5, 6 foot diameter fresh burn circles on the ground. There were caterpillar tracks. And they lifted the tarpaulin and they found 15, as I recall being told, canisters about 3 foot long, 5 inches in diameter with military markings on them. They dropped the tarpaulin and a few minutes later, a voice shouts out at them. And a man comes running over, American sounding accent, demands to know if they've looked under the tarpaulin, and they, scared, say, no, no, no. He's joined by two others and they are told to clear off. He flashes some form of identification at them and tells them there to go. So they leave, and this is what I just said was what they reported to Granada TV that night. The following morning, they get up, they go out, back on the hill, back to the spot they had been, and they get the farmer out. The farmer goes nuts. Some caterpillar track vehicle had come from the tar sealed road straight up the hill, smashed through the dikes, stone dikes, had done some sort of curve, and here was the evidence of these three burn circles, and everything had disappeared. Now, I find it interesting coincidence, just like this telephone conversation I know for a fact is being listened to. And I'm talking to somebody about this one day. Within a matter of days, I have a military personnel comes on the property, and he's a quartermaster sergeant major, and he confirms to me, yes, Dean, you're quite right. That is exactly how. I said, when I was in the military, we always broke the bits apart. There'd be the middle section, which had all of the rocketry propellant. We had the tail section, which was the guidance, and we had the nose piece, which was the destructive power. I said, yes, yes, you're quite right, you're quite right. Although he's not telling me that somebody's been listening to me, I am quite certain somebody has, and somebody's coming on the property to confirm the story. Now, the interesting thing to this is that there were two policemen, and they came down, I think it was the A-74, and let's register, that night was a filthy night. Wind was blowing a gale. and the plane is up around 30,000 feet. These two policemen stopped their car and said, "Oh my God, there's a plane gone up." "Oh, wait a minute. What did they see?" "I have been trained, I was trained in the military to do a lot of damage behind enemy lines with explosives. I didn't recall ever seeing a flame, any form of color, explosion visible from an explosive. Now they are seeing something going up, and the liners, oh, they saw the gas tank. It exploded. That, as far as I'm concerned, is absolute rubbish. They certainly saw something. It was a filthy night. So what did they see? They saw, they said, they described it as being like white lightning. And that's the giveaway. Just like I'm going to tell you about something else, the event of Acca, the giveaway of the 26th of December. But the giveaway of that Lockerbie disaster is that those poor policemen saw something which was up 30,000 feet and way in the distance, and they describe it as white lightning. That tells me what they had in the actual detonation part to the nose cones of those rockets. That plane was shot down.
Shot down, I was just going to say that. It sounds like it.
Yes. I mentioned the business of Acca. One thing that I did do in the States was that I was involved in a weapons system development of, which was so powerful that it could never be tested. I made a nuclear bomb.
It could never be tested.
Could never test it. A nuclear bomb, forget it, waste of time. This was piece de resistance. It was the ultimate weapon. And it was so simple. And again, it was based on sound. The interesting thing was, this was early doors, 1968. And David, who was the head of the research department, he says to me, and all this nonsense about the Russians versus the Americans, Dean, forget it. He says, "We've got Russians in these laboratories and we've got Americans over there. We tell each other everything." So we have a tsunami on the 26th of December. But what actually happened was that the early warning system gave out an announcement on the 24th of December, 2 days before, that there had been a volcanic explosion 800 miles south of Tasmania, 9.4 Richter scale. Now, the Acca explosion was 8.9. 9.4 minus 8.9 is 0.5. 0.5 means 5 times the power. So in other words, the 24th of December was 5 times the power of the Acca explosion. My sister in the States confirmed, because when I mapped back to 800 miles south of Tasmania, we've got a measurement. And it was the New Zealand government who gave it away by stating that on the 24th of December, 39 whales and dolphins had beached themselves on New Zealand beaches that day. Now, whales and dolphins do not beach themselves due to volcanic explosions. But they certainly beach themselves due to events relating to sonar. My sister said that you can, with many of these events, you can go to a department of geology department, a department of volcanology, anybody who reads a seismograph machine, and they will tell you certain things, and you know, that's kosher, that ain't. Anyway, my sister said, no, the students in Southern California were on it like a shot, and questions were asked, and they said, this is not a volcanic explosion. This was sonar eventing of 235 dBA pulsed. And questions were asked, and I don't know who it was, connected with the American government, some form of exploration team, and they said, oh, we were looking for oil. Well, I've never heard of oil being found under a fault line. That's where this explosion took place. You look for oil under a tectonic dome out in a tectonic plate somewhere. But the interesting thing for me is that if you take a protractor and and you look at the distance, the measurement from 800 miles south of Tasmania on the same fault line as Acca, you will find that Acca is exactly 60 degrees. And that is what we were working on back in 1968 as to be the flip-flop reaction from an input, which at that time we didn't know how we would be able to control it. And so it was never used. It was never experimented with. And that, for me, is what was Acca, the result of Acca. And what's in behind it? Well, a lot of people benefited, didn't they, from the tsunami of the Indian Ocean. A lot of people got killed, but that's all to the good, isn't it?
Reduces the population, and also quite a few people benefited by the rebuilding and so forth.
Not only that, we reduced significantly the number of people that were going on holiday to the Indian Ocean. More money was spent back home. We have the biggest, what I would call, slave labor of any European country of Indonesians is Switzerland. The people are subservient. They're subjected to the nonsense. And it's, again, the gun barrel right in the front of everybody, right there in everybody's face. And people, they just believe what they see. They don't accept. They don't realize that it's a game that's been played against them. And all those poor innocents who are, in the meantime, killed. And so it's like you take the case of the Darwin hurricane going back, what was it, 15 years ago? And it was discovered that, 200 miles off the coast, there was some readings, again, that university students, graduates picked up on, that there was some harp experiment being played off the coast of Darwin. So a hurricane comes in, and it is the case that the Australian economy was in a poor state, and it was Builders of Australia Unite.
Yes, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. Now, Dean, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to say a few words. I've heard quite a few reports on the underground bases, underground cities, and so forth.
Well, the underground side of things that I know of was that what we were brought up, we were taught in schools, and I'm 64 years of age, so I'm talking over 50 years ago when I was 10. And New Zealand had a very close relationship with the former Soviet states, and we got a lot of information from them, and we were taught in school that, I can't remember if it was 47 or 48, but Eisenhower, who was the head of the armed forces in the United States still at that stage, he had heard of something which was going on in the area of Dulles, New Mexico. He ordered in the troops. He lost 350 men in the battles that took place.
He lost 350 men?
He lost 350 of his troops, and he said, nuke the bastards. The people of Dulles, New Mexico were emptied from their homes during the night. My doggy mother said, don't worry about your dog, ma'am. Get in that damn truck. And they were taken out of town. Interestingly, at just after 5 a.m., and this, for me, relates back to an admission made by the head of Thermonuclear Physics Department of Scientific and Industrial Research New Zealand, who was on television in the UK and let slip something about nuclear explosions. You never heard from him again. But anyway, at just after 5 in the morning, two nuclear atomic blasts tear this place to pieces, and the American government put out the release they were looking for gas seams. Now, this is just farce. But as to what goes on underground, there's anybody's guess unless you've been a part of it. Now, I was fortunate that I didn't become a part of it, although I nearly did. Because of what I had done in the United States, I was offered a job. I was approached by the head of department at UCLA and offered the possibility of a place with a group called International World Game. And they were based in Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I subsequent to that found out, and particularly from Alexander Christopher's book, Pandora's Box, of what goes on underground and what has been reported to go on underground there. And anybody who's interested in that should look up the internet internet site on New World Order and recognize what has been done by the Masons, what has been spent, the amount of money it must have cost them, I would have thought $250,000 to build what they've done. And as you go around this gallery, attached to the New World Order International Airport, Denver, you come to the last piece where it says it's apologizing to the children. It shows, it depicts the most horrific means of killing of children all around this gallery, this library, which the Masons built. And it says, one day you will be set free. On the floor, it has a mosaic depiction of evolution of a type of man. And anybody who's followed it, studied it, knows we didn't come out of any ape. We developed along beside ape. We don't have the same, there's something wrong with our back, with the base of our spines, which do not relate to ape. When testing has been done, research has been done, to look backwards on the development of man, we come out of intelligent dinosaur. And here on the floor shows something which relates to, and as I said, I think I did say earlier on in this, in the Bible, it does not say that Cain slew Abel. It says that Cain ate him.
That is quite something. Have you heard from any of your contacts or intelligence sources, Dean? I've had reports, various people I've interviewed, on bases as big as cities that are up to 4 miles underground. We mentioned Dulce. Another one of my correspondents, he was a former MI6 man, and he said that they have these in various parts of in Europe and in the UK, especially under Lake Neath and Mildenhall.
Well, I've heard of them. I don't have any first-hand information, and your information is probably more accurate than mine. As far, are we talking about some form of alien inhabitant, or...
Yes. Yeah, reptilians and so forth.
Yeah.
And,
well, the information that I can give you on that is a source from the House of Lords, and more than one, in fact. And that is that the House of Lords, the House of Commons, that building, although it's built on the site of some previous principal place of history, it's actually built, according to those who see and know what's going on inside, they say it's built over the top of a nest. And they have appearances from time to time which are of non-physical entity like yourself and me, and they go along with whatever is the event with these people, these things, but it goes further than that. Sir Peter Hill Norton, the first Lord of the Admiralty, was, he did some years ago seven, I think, television documentaries where he was interviewed. Now, here we've got a man who's got a reputation, who's got a position. He's not likely to come out and say silly things.
No.
And in one of these documentaries, he tells of an experience whereby he goes to lunch with another admiral, and they're sitting down, they start to eat their meal, and one of them says, "So, beg your pardon, it was Peter Hill Norton." He says, "So what did you think then?" And the other admiral says, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Well, you know, the memo I sent you. Now, in high up in the armed forces, you're not allowed to talk on telephones, internal telephones. You've got to meet face-to-face and discuss. So there's no overhearing what's going on." And the input message to begin this is carried by top line security from one person to another person within the same building. And this other admiral says, he says, "I never got your memo from you." He says, "Yeah, the other day I sent you memo, so and so, so and so." He says, "No, I haven't had a memo from him." And Peter Hill General Norton says, they both got up from the table, they went to security, and the security were adamant. Nobody matching this description of this courier had ever worked for them. And that memo disappeared. Now, it's not just be at the House of Commons, the House of Lords, and I don't have any doubt that what my information tells me of, that there is something down beneath, that there is something down beneath, but it's not just there. It's in many, many places. And one of the things which brings us to, okay, things are not as what they might seem, is what I've been told of what goes on at Bantry Bay in Ireland. Now, I've been to Ireland many times, and we have, for example, over here where I live, we have chemtrails appearing quite regularly.
Yes.
And one has to wonder what it's about. So I go to Ireland, and I've heard that there are these events, and so I get out of bed at 6:30 one morning, and I set myself up a mattress on the drive in front of the farmhouse where I'm staying, and at 6:45, it starts, and a trail about 60,000 feet up. I can't see the aeroplane, so it's way above 30,000. You can see an aeroplane at 30,000 feet. Clear blue sky, and this line starts. And then as he gets to the horizon way back behind me, you see it spitting off the side of this trail, and it's starting to white out. If you held your hand up in the air, I see another chemtrail being formed, and it's from, say, the knuckle to the end of my thumb, apart from the other one. And by 11 o'clock in the morning, the whole of the sky is completely whited out with this spitting material coming out the sides of these chemtrails. Now, I have to ask the question, who is it? For the simple reason that the Irish Republic doesn't have an air force. So who's doing this? Now, people have told me who live around Bantry Bay. I go to Bantry Bay, and the people are upset because there was this event this particular day, and the sky was whited out with chemtrails. They watched them being formed. And the following morning, they'd woken up to find a spittle all over the streets. I'm trying to remember the name of the town, which is down the way down the peninsula. It's adjoining Great Bear Island. And the people were quite upset. They had an event of chemtrails this particular day, and the following day they'd come out to find there was a spittle all over the streets and on the leaves of bushes and on the grass, and some scientific type people had gotten together and taken samples and had this stuff analyzed and found that it contained hemoglobin. And the question is, well, why hemoglobin? Because hemoglobin happens to be one of the best preservers from high altitude to ground level of virus and bacteria. Now, there are no houses built on Bear Island overlooking Bantry Bay. Bantry Bay can hold the whole of the American submarine fleet. It's the deepest bay in Europe.
Yes.
And many who live on the other side of the bay say that they nightly, and sometimes daily as well, see flying saucer type technology comes into the water, no splashing, comes out of the water, no water dripping. Interestingly, supposedly retired American admiral has built a large complex at the head of the bay, and those who were involved in the construction say there was some phenomenal concrete medium communication lays were put between this building right down and out into Bantry Bay. The chemtrails, for me, I think we've got all sorts of experiment to try and send people loopy. I mean, the British government did admit a few years back, well, 10 years ago, I think, that they were experimenting on an area above Bath, 40 miles length, whereby they were then testing contact contacting hospitals in the area to see what it was people were reporting in as having as an affliction. The same sort of thing, Clinton was on television when he was president and said that they would have to pay compensation to some of the people close to the northern Texas border because, and I remember seeing the film footage of some of these people, the faces were so deformed it wasn't true.
Good heavens. Yeah, we certainly live in dangerous times, Dean.
Very much. Our problem is that the people are being fed not only junk on television, not only junk in the papers, but the food is so bad. We've got preservatives, agents within the food that turns the brains. People are not registering that which they would normally do.
Normally do.
No. And to try and tell the average person, they just think you're a raving nutter.
Absolutely. Having said that, I like to finish my presentations on a positive a note of hope. People are waking up. It's not quick enough for me. As we both know, the news industry is on its knees. This is why they're giving so many DVDs away. The insurance industry is also on its knees. That's where nearly everybody gets begging letters saying you can insure your car, your house, and this, that, and the other, and so forth.
Well, I just wish, David, that, you know, for a country, the UK, my father was from here, and as a child, I would be brought up listening to him saying, look at what they're doing. They're ruining this. They're ruining that. The greatest country in the world being destroyed from within by a few people. And I make no bones about it. Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson and the characters like that.
Yes.
I do not understand the infatuation for these people that the British have. If it's to go right, then the Brits have got to get their country back. And that means it's little groups, church halls, 50p to hire, whatever, talks and spread it around. And more people talking, more people saying, no, look, we've had enough of this nonsense.
Well,
they're supposed to be our peers, but they're not our peers.
Oh, they're not. They're just gangsters. The last 10 years, this is one reason I think I mentioned on our previous discussion, one reason I do tapes. It takes years to get a book off the ground. And I knew the content, it never reach the shows anyway. So I do tapes, and I can get tapes up pretty quick. Over the years, I do have quite a following, and I am grateful to people like your good self, who I call citizen journalists. They investigate themselves, they find the truth, and they're willing to speak, and I put it on tape and CD, and the information gets out. There's no copyright on any of my material. They're free to copy and pass on to their friends, and...
Well, the more the better, as far as I'm...
Absolutely. Well, this has been a most informative discussion, Dean, and I would like to thank you for your kindness and cooperation in joining Revelation Tapes, and keep up the good work and keep banging the drum.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.